We're all looking to make more sustainable choices, but making your own shoes out of natural materials could pose a few challenges. At the Allbirds Innovation Lab, they're doing all the sciencey stuff like research and testing to create shoes from natural materials, like leather made from plants, eucalyptus tree fiber, and sugarcane. It's not rocket science, it's shoe science. Allbirds is making shoes better than natural. They're supernatural. Find your perfect pair at allbirds.com today. That's allbirds.com.
Welcome to Sentimental Garbage, a podcast where we talk about the culture we love that society sometimes makes us feel ashamed of. My name is Caroline, and if I could go back in time, I would want to meet Snoopy. Joining me is a woman who thanks God every day she knew the words to Enter Sandman, Andrea Cleary.
That is me.
DeJour means family.
DeJour means family. Those DeJour boys, I'd really forgotten. Like their
yeah
impact, like it just in terms of getting the comedic tone right off the bat,
it's so good,
that opening scene, like,
oh, so good. So like, we're talking about Josie and the Pussycats today, and talking about that, even that DeJour opening scene, and like, I hope most people will seek out this movie. I imagine lots of people plugging this in will not have watched it because it was such a Barry classic. It like was really hated when it came out, and has kind of recently regained the status of a cult classic, I think, because the contemporary sense of humor has caught up with the sense of humor of the film, kind of. It's sort of, it feels like jokes that would work on Twitter or work on TikTok, you know? They're very, like, neat, odd jokes. But it was so despised. But that opening sort of segment with DeJour, who are this manufactured boy band, and we're having all these scenes with them on the plane, and it's so funny. It really, when I watched it, I was like, oh, if the whole film had been just these boys, it would have been a hit. If it would have been like the exact same script, the exact same thing of the boys finding out that their music has subliminal messaging in it, all that, people would have fucking loved it.
Well, that's because that's what Zoolander was.
Yes, exactly. Right? That's Zoolander. Like, yeah.
And I think Zoolander came out the same year.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
maybe a bit later in the year. So this is 2001, Josie and the Pussycats comes out. Comes out in April, which is a notoriously difficult month. Like, studios put movies out in April if the movie doesn't have a big backing, really.
And why is that? Because it's not quite the summer crowd. It's not quite the Christmas crowd.
It's not
crowd.
Christmas. It's not summer. Right. It's kind of somewhere in the middle. So they're kind of putting their more risky, like if they don't mind if the movie kind of doesn't, you know, become a big hit. And like this year, 2001 is The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring. It's
Moulin
the first
Rouge.
Harry Potter movie. It's Moulin Rouge. It's absolutely massive films. And this film, like the cult status that it has now, really does feel recent. Like there are women who have loved this film for their whole lives. But in terms of critical reappraisal, it does really feel recent. And maybe it's because the anniversary would have been like last year.
Yeah. And there was actually a bit of a sort of victory tour of the actors sort of doing the 20-year anniversaries and stuff. But like, it's been reappraised to the point now where like, so I'm in Dublin today. I'm on location.
Yeah.
And we're using the Tall Tales studio where the podcast Juvenalia with Sarah Griffin and Alan McGuire, who've both been on Sentimental Garbage before, record their podcast. And they are, just by pure coincidence, recording a Josie and the Pussycats episode after this one.
Today.
Same studio.
Like, if this is happening in one studio in Dublin, think how many studios right now around the world are recording their episodes about Josie and the Pussycats.
Yeah, it's like we're all just ready at the same time. Yeah. And I think I'm going to do the plot summary, but after that, I want to talk about why we think we're ready now.
Okay.
So, Josie and the Pussycats is a 2001 movie about the Archie Comics property of the same name. It follows the story of Josie, Val, and Melody, a struggling girl band who are suddenly signed to a record deal with Mega Records when the manufactured boy band DeJour mysteriously disappear. The girls discover that they are the center of a major conspiracy to insert subliminal messages into music to brainwash teenagers to buy trend items. And then they sort of take down the massive corporation with the power of friendship. And even when they're doing that, when they're having these, like, you know, epiphanies about, like, you're not what you wear, you're who are you are inside. Mm. There's even this sort of sly wink being like, yeah, okay, we know that's a kind of a bold thing to put in a movie, but you yeah. know, it's silly, but okay, kind of thing.
Yeah, like it's satirizing. There's so many kind of metatextual levels of satirization within this film that if you were to break it down to its component parts, you'd get dizzy. Like it's mm-hmm. satirizing, obviously, the consumer culture. It's satirizing the music industry. It's satirizing girl bands and teenagers and boy bands. But it's also satirizing films like this,
yes.
where everything is like wrapped up at the end. Even the love interest in it is so underwritten and boring.
It's just Alan like, M.
Alan M. Like, I don't know what you're doing about the letter, honey. Yeah. Like,
didn't work for Sheila E., doesn't work for you.
It's brilliant. But like this really just kind of nothing love interest. And I know that he is an Archie Comics character. He's a Riverdale
yeah,
character.
Yeah, they all are, right? Yeah,
they all are. But like he plays basically no role yeah. in this film.
Yeah.
And
like he's supposed to be a musician too. And there's a scene where he has a gig, an open mic in a pub, and they cut away.
Yeah.
And we don't even hear like a note of what Alan M has to say.
Yeah. And what is the character's name who's always with him? The girl, and she has the I'm with the band sign.
Yes. I think her name is Alexandria, and she's played by Missy Pyle, who's yeah. so fucking good.
So funny in this film.
Ooh, you slept with him. How did you get Mr. Movie Phone? You slept with him.
You slept with him. She doesn't give a shit throughout this whole film. Like she's near the beginning when they're on the jet. It's like, mm-hmm. why are you here? It's like, because I'm in the comic books.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
like, it's so like self-aware and overt about it not taking anything seriously.
And it's
the whole film.
It almost like it tries to sort of, you know, and this was even people who got the movie but still criticized it. It got what it was trying to do, but was still like, nah. We're like, is this not kind of having your cake and eating it? Mm. If you're like going to critique this crass consumerist culture but still market Barbie dolls.
Sure.
You know,
yeah,
which
yeah.
I do kind of get. And then even in the movie, you can see the merch that they plan to release. And that merch does get released.
That goes on to get released. And yeah, there were Barbie, like there were dolls. Mm-hmm. Well, action figures, really. They're a band.
Yeah,
come on.
They're action figures. Yeah,
they're performing actions, and
which I would fucking love to have one of those dolls. Or anyone wants to make my year. Yeah,
like the little ears that they have at the end in like the end closing scene at the stadium concert, and yeah, all of that. But I think like this film and why it was such a commercial and critical flop is that there is just this like misunderstanding between the people that were making the film and the studio that were merchandising and promoting the film. Mm-hmm. There was just this like, I don't know if you've ever done Jennifer's Body on this podcast.
I'm planning to get it. Yeah.
Well,
it's
like they're kind of sister films in that way, where it was
so
just
true.
Such a misunderstanding of who the film needed to be marketed to, mm-hmm. which was teenage girls, but not like that, you know, not like here's Josie and the Pussycats, three sexy little kiddies who your dad can bring you to see this film.
Yeah, like, and there's something in for him too, wink
exactly,
wink kind of thing.
Like, yeah, it was marketed as this like very strange, like, because it's not a film for kids really. I watched it when I was a kid. I watched it probably around about the time it came out on video, so in Ireland in 2001, maybe like 2 years after after it actually had its release. But like, it's not for kids. There's swearing in it, there's adult jokes in it, but it's
there's
also
like a cocaine joke in it.
There's a cocaine joke, yeah,
yeah, when she's Fiona, is that her name? Yeah,
Fiona,
the record
yeah
exec, she's pushing all this like white dust off of like a control palette. It's
yeah,
like, it's blink and you miss it.
Yeah,
like,
or
yeah,
the honk if you like Pussycats,
yes,
sign,
yes,
at,
yes,
the, at the beginning of it. But yeah, the misunderstanding of like, who is it that we market this to? Because I think, well, whoever was running the marketing team on this was probably underfunded, and we're just like, oh, we'll just like, it's for girls, so we'll what's in the movie? Oh, there's little ears. We'll put out the little ears or the little handbags or whatever it is. I don't think they watched the movie because it's so obviously satire that the misreading of it as being like there were reviews of it at the time that called the movie hypocritical for all of the product placement that was in it. And it's like, are you serious?
The product placement is the point of the movie. And it's also, it's not technically product placement because they didn't pay, like they didn't get any money for any of this.
They didn't get any money. They didn't clear it.
Yeah.
Like, at all, it's from
fucking,
anybody.
It's fucking punk rock to do that.
It's really, like, ballsy. Yeah. Like, and that is, like, some of the best visual gags. Like, the Evian aquarium gag is one of my favourite moments in the film because, like, or the Ray-Bans on the, on what's his name? Wyatt's, like, van when he first sees them.
Yeah.
He's got, like, Ray-Ban branding on his truck and it's everywhere. It is. Yeah. I think there's something like 75 company different companies, and not counting the different like variations of that company logo. So you'd have like the Motorola M, or you'd have like it's spelled out or whatever. But even just having Motorola in it, is so early.
It's everywhere, and but it's like it's the creation of a real universe, you know? Because obviously this is like a they mention Riverdale by name, obviously because it's the world of the Archie comics, but like. They're not, when they like, I noticed this time around, when they go to like the city, it's they're not going to New York or LA. It's just called like kind of the city. It's like, they've created a universe wherein when you're in your own hotel room, there's product placement everywhere. And that's just like when Tara Reid's character is in the shower, she's washing herself with McDonald's things. And that's like, it's the world. It's a different world. It's not supposed to be our world. But one of the reasons why I feel almost like people are kind of coming round to it again and why podcast studios globally are recording a podcast right now about it is like they have made this this fictional satire-based world that is supposed to be an emphasis of our own, but that has actually become sort of the world that we do live in. Because if we think about now, everyone sort of has this digital half-life, right? And those worlds are so filled with product placement. Like our Instagrams or Twitters are everything we look at online. Even when we read a news story and there's like a banner advert for a company or whatever, we have accepted that as being totally part of the norm, you know?
Even within the music industry, like when you read a Pitchfork review of an album, there's affiliate links within it and they have to state below it.
Yeah.
Pitchfork earns money from affiliate links. If you follow this link through and buy the... you know, the LP of the new Kendrick Lamar album, we're going to make a few bob out of that.
Yeah.
And that, like, that's what they were kind of talking about in this film early on, even before, like, the web played such a role in the music industry. It's
Or even
amazing.
Before, like, Dre was doing beats. Do you know what I mean? Before it became a thing where, okay, it's, you know, musicians can't get by just selling CDs and gig tickets anymore because of streaming, etc. So now they need to make things. And, you know, we just did a series on Indie Twee, and what that meant was them making buttons and badges and tote bags and drawing handmade thingies. And for bigger artists, that meant creating $200 headphones that are still the best-selling headphones today, even though when's the last time Dr. Dre put out a song? You know what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah. It's really interesting. I find what they do with the music industry in this film very interesting because it's like, it's the same criticisms that we have of it now, but it's more heightened in the movie, and the movie came out in 2001.
Yeah.
Like, I really think this film was so ahead of its time in terms of how it satirizes how pop works. And also just the sound of the film. Like, this was just when Blink 182 and the pop punk sound was kind of coming out. We'd just come out of grunge. Boy bands were maybe like on the, like, starting to go.
Yes, it was the era of, like, you know, okay, Backstreet Boys and, you know, NSYNC had made all the money they were gonna make.
Yes.
But now we were getting, like, the LFOs.
Yes.
And the, O-Town, is that one of them?
Yeah, or
were
they, O-Town,
Are they heavier? I can't remember. But yeah, it was like it was eking out, the formula was becoming hilarious kind of thing.
Yes.
Which is why the du jour stuff is so good.
Du jour, man. Even the name du jour is so funny. Like, because it's completely believable that there would be a band called du jour. Yeah. And it's very, it's made very, very clear at the beginning of the film that they don't sing their own songs.
Yeah.
That they're all dumb as shit.
Yeah.
But, like, even they figured out about the subliminal messages in their music. And then, obviously, take the Chevy to the levee. Yeah.
Take the Chevy to the levee.
Brilliant.
That, like, surely, it, like, fucking Roger Ebert or whatever, or any sort of similar thinking critic.
Yeah.
At that moment, and we're talking 7 minutes into the film, right? When the Alan Cumming's character, Wyatt, is deciding that, you know, he needs to kill off his boy band, goes into the cockpit and says, take the Chevy to the levee.
It's such a good joke.
It's such a good joke. But surely then you would have known, like, oh, this film is not what I think it's going to be, and it's having fun with that.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's such a fucking smart joke.
It's such a smart joke. And even when du jour, like, arguing with each other, like, oh, why do I have a goatee on the Coke can when everyone knows in this era I had a soul patch?
Yeah, yeah.
And just the kind of the pettiness. Du jour is friendship and it's all of it. Like, they're so dumb. And what's really nice about it, obviously, is that Josie and the Pussycats, the band, are smart and clever and they're small town girls. Them being small town girls, like, we don't actually get to know anything about their class except that Josie kind of works on a bad car a little bit.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, I told you not to drive it uphill. This car is too good for you or whatever. Yeah. But beyond that, it's like...
She just knows how to fix cars.
She kind of knows how to fix cars and she plays the guitar and she's really cool. But that's kind of all we get to understand about their backstory.
Yeah.
Like, we don't see a whole lot of struggle with them or anything.
Yeah, there's a montage at the beginning, which... It's so weird because you have the du jour moment, which is so fucking funny and it feels like an SNL sketch, right?
Mm.
And then you have this long credit sequence that's just like introducing the three characters. What are their personalities? What's their deal? The film is very like, we're not going to spend much time in this hometown. So let's just give you what you need to know about who these girls are. One of them is kind of a sexy tomboy and she's in a record shop with a stack of CDs and da-da.
Yeah.
And like, then there's, and that's Josie. And then there's Val and she's like kind of a humanitarian and she's sort of, reading to kids at the library.
Oh,
and
I forgot about that.
All that stuff.
Yeah.
And then there's
Never comes up again.
Never comes up again. But she's like an activist and she's an organizer and all this. Never fucking come.
Never again.
The thing is, if they remade this movie today, that would be the whole movie.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
It was Rosario Dawson's character just being like, you know. Like,
just being woke.
Yeah, exactly.
For the whole thing, yeah.
And then there's Tara Reid's character, Melody, who just loves animals and is a dope.
The dopiest little thing. Like, she's kind of as dumb as du jour are.
Yeah.
And she's really sweet. Like, I love Tara Reid in this movie.
It's the best she's ever been in
this movie.
I think
she's so funny.
It's a movie that really understood her comedy.
Yeah.
Which is quite specific.
Because
it is this sort of... I think every movie that she was ever in was like, this is the sexy sex pot or whatever.
Because she'd just been in American Pie.
Yeah,
so the studio were really, really excited about having got her for this. They were like, okay, great, hit maker. She's just been in American Pie.
And
she's
Cook
super hot.
Was a big deal as well.
She's all that. Rosario Dawson, I think, had been doing more
TV
like
movies
serious
and stuff.
So she was like the actor.
Yeah.
But
the thing with Tara Reid that like she was so misused, I think, because she is this gorgeous sort of California blonde and she has this kind of husky voice.
Best voice in Hollywood,
so
even to
good.
This day.
This kind of raspy.
So
she's
hot.
Like,
just the hottest voice.
Invented. Vocal fry kind of thing. That she would often just be a sultry girl who like you would dream of getting with, and she was the guy. She was something that the guys would lust after. But in this, she's just this sweet little person who almost doesn't know how hot she is. And you kind of believe it. She's like this Cocker Spaniel person. And like... It's just, she has some of the funniest lines in the movie. Just even her saying, coasters.
She just loves those coasters. It's very, very, very sweet. And she's, you kind of understand why she's taken in by all of it. Because it's not really clear like who it is that is manipulating her. She's just kind of going along for the ride. It's much more like Josie's story of manipulation. Because Val... kind of cops on because she's smart and a humanitarian. And like she gets it. So it's much more about Josie's manipulation. But with Melody, you're just kind of like, yeah, just go get your record deal, girl. Just go be hot
on a big
billboard and have a nice time. And I like that, you know, one of the criticisms that was leveled against this film was that they were too like sexed up and that their clothes
they dress like Hooters
skimpy.
They're
a pop band. This is what pop bands look like, but it like they wear
their outfits are fucking sensational as well.
They're amazing,
like, but like every single thing they wear I want.
But any moment in it where they're like hypersexualized, it is like in text the industry doing that to them. It's not the film doing it. The film isn't trying to get you in by showing you Tara Reid's pubic bone, like which is there. It's like those low-rise trousers are present because it was 2001 and this is what
it was. The style of the time
and it's the style of the now, it would seem, from what I'm told about TikTok, that this is all coming back. And yeah, maybe that's something to do with the resurgence as well, that this style of clothing is coming back as well.
This style of music is coming back as well. I was thinking that because I remember I came to this movie through the soundtrack first.
Okay, that's so interesting.
And the soundtrack, you know, the pedigree of the soundtrack is actually well known. Even the people who hate this movie will still be like, okay, it had Adam Duritz, Adam Schlesinger of Fountains of Wayne, R.I.P.
Yeah.
A real one. A real one, you
like
know?
An absolute true real one.
Like really sad. That
understood.
He also
so
wrote the songs on some of the songs on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Like, yeah. The musical landscape is different because of Adam Schlesinger. I'm so sad he's gone.
Yeah.
But yeah, he wrote some of the songs, and the someone from the Go-Go's.
The Go-Go's, and then Kay Hanley from
Letters to Cleo.
Letters to Cleo was the...
Yeah.
Also wrote some of the songs and is Josie's singing voice in the film.
So I had a friend who had the soundtrack, and then we listened to it, and then I was obsessed with the soundtrack first, and then I was like, oh, and the movie was exactly my sense of humor anyway, kind of thing. So I was like 13, and I think there's an assumption that, you know... The writers of this movie and the director of this movie, everybody who worked on this film who wasn't in the marketing department, understood that a film could both be for 14-year-old girls and be clever and funny kind of thing.
Yeah.
And a real satire that they would really get and that they would recognize. And they would recognize these sort of the way that these trends are pushed on them and that they would get that. And I don't think the people who marketed it or the people who reviewed it had that kind of faith in teenage girls.
Absolutely. That is precisely it. It's that, like... There's the assumption that it's because it's so clever and it's satire that it's not appropriate for young teenage girls because they're not going to get it.
Like, yeah.
I watched this when I was 13 or...
Yeah.
Like, I got it.
Yeah, no, exactly.
I totally got it.
It's not one of those stories where it's like, oh, I watched it and I loved it and then I came back as an adult and I saw the messages. I was like, no, I saw the messages then too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this was like, I watched this 2 years before I watched Fight Club, which was my favorite movie as a teen because I was insufferable, but I still love that movie to this day.
I love it.
But like Fight Club is so applauded for how it uses, you know, the fact that there's a Starbucks cup in every shot and how it critiques and satirizes consumerism and masculinity.
Yeah.
But Josie and the Pussycats just isn't given that same kind of level of understanding or same good faith. That it understood what it was doing. And if the movie was about De Jure, if the movie was about like a kind of a Blink-182 male pop band, it absolutely would have been huge.
I fully agree.
Totally.
And like, I think I saw this on a YouTube sort of video essay that I watched earlier today that I'm going to include a note to in the show notes. I can't remember what the name of it is now. But they made this comparison, scene by scene comparison of in Wayne's World 2, they make the exact same joke.
Yeah.
That thing of like
the Pepsi things.
The pizza, it's my choice and the choice of a generation.
Yeah.
And the what's those aspirins called? Little, yellow.
Pepto-Bismol or something?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's like basically a long scene of them doing all the things and everyone gets it.
Yeah.
You know?
And Josie is just that stretched over the length of a movie.
Yes. But also the thing is that like I think it's so weird because satire is supposed to be silly, right? Mm. And yet it's the thing that people seem the most intent on being serious about.
Mm.
Like people are so serious about what counts as satire. Mm. And I think there's an assumption that if you're going to make satire, it has to be like, you know, Doctor Strangelove or something.
Sure.
It can't be something where you also care about the characters. And like, you can be like, this is a great satire of the music industry and commercialism. But I also care about these girls and I care about their friendship and I care about their music. And I believe them.
Yeah. Like the three of them, they're not, you know, as we said, they're not like the most, like, they're not the deepest characters you're going to come across.
They're not very deeply written. No.
No. But I do, I believe their friendship. I believe they're friends with each other. And it's all done in this kind of like very quick way. But also they're so touchy-touchy with each other.
Yes.
And whenever they're in a scene together, I just believe that they would hang out with each other.
Yeah.
Like whenever Melody says something stupid, they don't look at her annoyed. Yeah. Or they just kind of look at her and they're like,
so fond of her. Like,
yeah.
You know?
Which is why it's so shocking when Josie later on, when she gets manipulated by the song, when she is so mean to Melody by saying, like, puppies grow up and become dogs and die of old age. And it's actually really sad, that moment.
It's so ridiculous and so funny, but it's actually
very sad. It's really, really sad. And then there's like,
she would wound Melody in this way.
Yeah.
And know how to wound her.
And then Melody goes and like seeks out some puppies. And it's like this big like crying montage thing. And she's like looking at the puppies and is very upset. And I can't remember what she does to, what does she do to hurt Val? I think Val just kind of copped on quite early.
Yeah.
She's a smart one.
Yeah.
And then obviously the TRL thing happens, which is amazing.
With Kirsten Daly. Which is such a bizarre scene.
It is wild.
It's wild, like. It's I can see why people who weren't giving this good faith or getting it being like, I don't
know. It felt improvised.
It feels felt improvised.
Like all
yeah.
The spoken moments in it were improvised. But I do like, this isn't Total Request Live. This is Total Request Dead. Like, I'm into that. I like that.
It's great. But like, Chris Daly has this comedian with him. I don't know who the comedian is. Maybe he meant something in 2001.
Yeah, I feel like I remember his face being around. And he just keeps doing impressions of Eddie Murphy and...
Chris Rock and Bill Cosby.
Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
And none of them are good. Which is funny.
Which
I
is
guess.
Part of it.
Yeah, I don't know why he's there.
I feel like someone who was a grown-up in 2001 is going to phone in and be like, you know, this is who that was.
He is the reason why, like, SNL is what it is today or something. We don't know, I'm sorry.
We don't know, we weren't there.
We care about the women in this film. But, I mean, Wyatt,
Alan Cumming.
He's really hot in this film. I don't
remember.
Do
you really?
Yeah, I think he's really hot.
I think you need to go over to the other podcast.
No, I think
where Sarah Griffin is.
Yes.
Probably fucking frottaging the seat to Alan Cumming right now.
I think he's... Well, see, I fancy funny men who are able to take the piss out of themselves. Mm. And for me, I'm like, this is a hot role for you.
Oh, I totally think Alan Cumming has been hot to me in previous iterations.
But not in this role.
Not in this role.
Okay, fair. That's okay.
Tell me, talk
Parker
me through
Posey.
It.
So it's not his character. Uh-huh. It's that he did this film and believed in the project.
It's that, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that, because he's doing the Richard E. Grant role in Spice World, right?
Yes. Which is hot.
Hot. I mean, Richard E. Grant is like fucking, oh my God.
Yeah.
I think I feel about Richard E. Grant the way you and Sarah feel about Alan Cumming. Mm. Just sort of men who, like straight men who are man enough to be camp.
Yes.
Is that's the horniest thing to me.
Precisely it.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. Like that he, that
and
he
I'm not
trusted...
talking about Harry Styles.
No. Completely different thing.
Different thing.
Yeah. I can't think of other examples actually. There are loads.
It's like a sort of a willingness to be sort of fey and like
just be a bit silly and be amongst the women and have the women be the joke.
Yeah,
but you're just kind of along for the ride because you believe in the project and the cast and the music. All of that to me is really hot.
Yeah, and he's completely present. Like he's giving his best.
He's so funny.
This is not something that he did because he money or whatever. No. You can tell he thinks it's funny. And him and Parker Posey are so good together.
They're such a good duo. I think I read that they came as a duo, that they got one of them first.
Oh, wow.
I think it was they got Alan Cumming first and then Parker Posey was like, okay, if Alan's doing it, I'll do it.
I can so see them being friends.
Yeah.
Oh, I love
that. Which I think is really sweet. Because I think they'd worked together before. And the writers and directors of this film made a film before as well that I haven't seen, but apparently was like very well loved. I can't remember what it was called. Okay. But then they wrote Josie and the Pussycats and it bombed and they said that they would never write or direct another film again.
Fuck me. Yeah. Wow.
I bet it's not because it bombed.
I bet it's because the months leading up to that bombing, they probably knew. And they were they were probably like, you know, on fucking conference calls every day being like, no, it's not this, please, we love this, we spent a year making it, we all had a great time making it and we want the
and
best
it's good.
For it and it's good and we think it could be as big as Wayne's World or something.
Yeah.
But and I bet it wasn't the fact that it bombed, I bet it was the year leading up to the bombing that
and
breaks your soul.
They didn't test it. They had no test screenings because the test screening they were supposed to have, there was a storm that day. Like,
and that's why it's as good as it is, because it wasn't reshot, right? Yeah. And wasn't testing badly among, you know, whatever.
So I think they had smaller test screenings from I think it was Universal Pictures that produced it or that distributed it. And they had smaller test screenings for, like, the people who needed to see it in Universal, and they didn't like it. Yeah. So it was getting a bit like, oh, God, but this is coming out soon.
Yeah.
And then it came out, and what is the woman's name who wrote and directed it? I can't remember either of their names now, but she went on like a Friday the opening night. Mm-hmm. And there was like five people in like a screening, just like her local screening or whatever, whereas she'd been used to on films that she'd worked on before, like people sitting in the aisles, like
fucking hell.
And she was like, oh God, no, this is it, it's over. And I think the studio said to them, it's dead on arrival, it's not it's not going to make any money, which is...
That's so upsetting.
It's so upsetting because I guess like, it's not as if there wasn't a precedent for this film to do well. Like Charlie's Angels had just come out.
Yeah.
Bring It On had come out the year before. Like, so kind of lowish budget films.
There's even a Charlie's Angels joke in the movie, right?
Yeah, exactly.
When the Pussycats are having their big hype moment, there's a thing being like Lucy Liu, Cameron Diaz and Drew Barrymore to play Josie and the Pussycats.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny. Like, it's really funny. So that was out. And I think... Not Save the Last Dance, the other one that I always confuse it with, Coyote Ugly.
Oh,
that
yeah.
came out the year before as well. So
the Horse and Mental Garbage back catalogue.
Exactly. Yeah. The sentimental garbage films came out, were marketed towards women, starred women, some of them directed by women, and low-ish budgets, but box office hits. So it's kind of understandable that the studio would be like, okay, we can give you this low budget, but we expect... quite a lot back, but just not nailing that marketing. Killed it, absolutely killed it. And maybe America wasn't ready for it yet.
Yeah.
Because it's a really smart film.
But like I say, we're ready for it now. Mm. And the thing, what I find so interesting, so as I mentioned, I found the soundtrack first, fell in love with that. I think I actually stole it from my friend's house.
And did you think that they were, that Josie, when you first heard Josie and the Pussycats, were you just like, oh, this is a band?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a real band. Yeah, exactly. And started a band with a girl in my class, like because of it and all that kind of then found sticking at the film. But the thing about the music is, and we actually had this conversation before when I got on your podcast, my favorite album, to talk about Fight Like Apes. It was this genre of music that I was desperate to find but could only find in films.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking of Letters to Cleo, that song at the end of 10 Things I Hate About You.
Yes, Cruel to Be Kind.
Cruel to Be Kind, yes. Oh, such a good
and
song.
And they did I Want You to Want Me as well for that.
Yes. Brilliant. I Want You to... Brilliant. Two brilliant songs. I'm going to make a playlist after this.
Yeah,
Of the Josie universe of songs.
Do. I will contribute to the playlist.
Please do. I'll share the link with you. But it was like, you know, Cruel to Be Kind, the Letters to Cleo. Who was the other one in films? Empire Records, Renee Zellweger doing her song.
Yeah.
This sort of like girl foot stampy pop punk. You got a little bit of it, No Doubt. And I was obsessed with No Doubt, that Tragic Kingdom album. But that was still, I still just didn't care enough about ska to care about.
Fair.
You know?
Yeah.
But the Just a Girl kind of moment.
Yeah. If No Doubt only ever played songs that sounded like Just a Girl and Don't Speak.
Yeah.
To me, that would have been like best band
Perfect.
In the world.
Yeah. 10 out of 10, yeah, exactly. No notes. Totally. And I was always, this was like a, just the early, early days of streaming where it took, you know, 2 days to download one song kind of thing.
Yeah.
I was always looking for this. Who were these bands? And then like going on these searches and finding they're kind of manufactured for this one film or whatever. And I couldn't find it anywhere. And I don't know why it was so missing. Probably because manufactured pop girl music, like your Spice Girls and everything that came after Spice Girls, was so shiny that female rock bands wouldn't want to do that, right? Yeah. Because they're reacting against that. So you got sort of heavier people like La Tigre or Hole.
Yeah.
I love Hole as well. I eventually did find Hole. But they were heavier, right? They weren't the sort of whirling around guitars, cool outfits, foot stamping, that kind of thing. But now I feel like that music is happening.
Yeah.
The music I'd wanted so desperately is everywhere now. Like, I think Maisie Peters, particularly that latest single, Kate's Brother, I'm like, that's a Josie and the Pussycats song.
Yeah, yeah. Even Olivia Rodrigo has a couple of pop songs as well.
Orla Gartland.
Yeah. Like, there is a lot of it around now. And I think it's a kind of a cultural correction in terms of, you know, the people who are music reviewers like myself now, or like women who want to go back and correct and say, actually, this music was good and we liked this. But you're totally right. Like Josie and the Pussycats kind of fills that gulf between shiny manufactured pop, which is really fun, and, you know, earnest lady guitar rock music.
Yeah.
And like lady guitar rock music is different to women who are in rock bands. Like, I want lady guitar
rock
music.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Which is the thing. It's like taking the sentimentality of pop and just putting some nice guitars to it and taking the seriousness out of guitar playing and drum playing. And it's like Tara Reid and the, like, melody in this film is dumb as shit, and she can play the drums really, really well.
Yeah.
And it's like, we don't need to intellectualize this music so much. Like, yeah. Just learn how to play a beat and it's fine. If she can do it, anyone could do it.
And she is doing it.
And she's doing it. They learned it. Yeah. Like, I mean, Rachel Lee Cook, her guitar playing's really quite believable.
Mm. I
think Tara and Rosario contribute backing vocals.
Yeah.
But Rachel's not on it. Because apparently she was brought in and she's brought in to test to see if she could sing. And they were like, look, if you can carry a tune, you can be on the soundtrack. And then they were like, no, we're going to get someone else.
You're a very talented girl, but no.
You're such a good actor.
She is a great actor.
She is. She's really, really good. But isn't this film kind of cited as being the reason why she didn't have a career?
Yeah.
That's so sad.
It's so sad.
Because she's brilliant.
She's brilliant.
That's so beautiful.
I can't believe that hair. That hair is responsible for all of my poor haircuts of my entire teens.
Yeah.
Just going into hairdressers with pictures of her and Veronica Mars.
Oh, yes.
Of, I want a choppy bob that sort of sticks out, and maybe I then I'm buying kind of gels.
The Fructus hair gel.
Yes, like, yes.
I can smell it right now.
And just never working. Like, that needs, and doing the thing where, like, buying a straightener and like holding it to flick it out. And it's just this sort of crispy right angle sort of thing happening in your head.
Absolutely so beautiful hair. Beautiful hair.
And that shade of red I was constantly trying to find that you can never do.
Sort of, not quite like chunky highlights, but there is a bit of, you can see that it would become the chunky highlight era.
Yes, yes.
Like, I think the looks in this film are really interesting just for how spot on they got 2001. Mm. Like, have you, I don't know what cause you would have had to do this, but like, when you get a chance, look up the red carpet for the premiere of this. It's stunning. Destiny's Child were there.
Oh, God.
Like, who else? Like, loads of people were there. What's your man from 24?
Kiefer Sutherland?
Yeah, he's there.
Fuck.
With his daughter, and his daughter is wearing, like, kitty ears.
Oh,
and
my God.
It's all, like Tara Reid is obviously dressed, like, outrageously with her whole body just there with, like, the important bits covered. Her. But, like...
I feel like Irish people are very connected to Tara Reid because she's very connected to Jedward.
How is she connected to Jedward?
They lived with her for a while.
Did they?
Yeah, they're like her best friends with her or something.
Oh.
Or so my friend Ryan tells me.
That's really sweet. Yeah, Jedward are having a reappraisal in Ireland. Everyone's just like, God, we were mean to them and they're great.
I'm waiting for someone to come on and say Jedward.
Really. Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. Like, walk outside the door there and just say, would anyone like to do a podcast about Jedward? You'll find somebody. Like,
I mean, our Ireland's sort of best Eurovision entry in years, I think.
Yeah.
Lipstick was a fucking banger.
Absolute banger.
But this isn't the Jedward podcast.
No, we was. But how did we get onto Jedward? Oh, yeah. The fashion in the film. Like, it's a funny... Because, I guess, Zoolander kind of covered fashion. And obviously, they did, the two films didn't, like, know what the other one was doing. Like, the fashion in the film is just what it is. I find it interesting that they don't wear branded clothes. Mm. There's no Abercrombie and Fitch. Like,
yeah, it's all custom.
Yeah. I think the only branded stuff is, like, you see people wearing, like, sneakers, like Reebok sneakers and stuff. Mm. But everything else is, like, quite custom. And, like, you have to think that is a decision to, like, maintain a bit of an allure about the women.
Yeah, and yeah, like, that they're sort of over and above these things.
Yeah.
Which is a really clever piece of styling.
Yeah.
And, like, the bit that I just, like, it really took my breath away when I watched it in my hotel room last night, when she's wearing the gown they sent over for the big party, the record company party.
The, like, skin, the snake skin kind of thing?
Yes.
It's like, backless?
A backless sort of leopard or snake or something with a plunging neckline. And but she's got this sort of chain going down the back.
It's so beautiful. It's so hot.
It's so... For such a scene that's been done a million times of, like, a man doing up a woman's thing.
Yeah. And that's, like, always hot to me. I like
it. It's always hot, but it's, like, particularly hot here. Like, he, again, very underwritten role for whoever the fuck that guy was. Yeah. But he brings it. Like,
yeah, he does.
You know, and, like, this sort of really well shot, sort of tracing the chain down the back. And she's got this, like, transfer tattoo.
Yeah.
Oh, like, that looks beautiful.
That triggered me, honestly. I was like, wow.
It makes me
really sexy.
Transfer tattoos need to come back. Yeah, I think they are back, actually, in a big way.
And kind of like, it had like kind of bejeweled.
Yes.
On it. It was beautiful.
Oh, so good.
I was completely taken out at that moment last night when my boyfriend turned around to me and, like, in that very kind of catty way, that very mean girl's way, was basically like, that's the ugliest effing dress I've ever seen in my life.
No!
I was like, oh, you don't get it.
You don't get it.
You don't get it. And he fell asleep before the end of the movie. And I was like, I've done this wrong. You shouldn't be here.
That's the thing, is that, like, sometimes when I do these assignments, I you know, Gav is involved as well. Mm. And, like, it's such a mixed bag. Because sometimes the straight man opinion, they can offer some strange gems from their worldview. Because they're so out of our universe. And they're coming to it so freshly. And they just give me these things. And I'm like, yes, this will go on the podcast. Yeah. Thank you. And sometimes... just like, get out.
I'm like, you don't get it. You don't get it.
Go for a run.
He loved Parker Posey from start to finish. Whenever Parker Posey was on screen, he was in stitches.
The Parker Posey outfits, man. The neck
the
pieces.
The feather thing?
Yeah.
That's one of the best things I've ever seen on screen, is that, like, feather, the thing where, like, she just looks like one of those, like, weird lamps that you would have had.
Yes!
Room, like, beside your lava lamp, or the one that looks like electricity or something, and then you have Parker Posey's head with this, like, feather monstrosity. It's so beautiful.
Like, I'm not that person who, like, you know, is like, when something that they like doesn't get the love that they want, goes like, this should have gotten the Oscar or whatever. I don't care about what gets the Oscar for what. It doesn't affect me. But at least for costume design.
Yeah.
I know Moulin Rouge would have taken it that year, and that's fair.
Yeah.
But a nomination, simple nomination.
Just for Parker Posey.
Yes.
Best person to wear a costume.
Oh my God.
Yeah, she's stunning. She's absolutely, she's so beautiful, and her clothes are so brilliant, and she's so maniacal. And I couldn't take my eyes off her. Like, even when she was just, like, slightly in the background of any scene, I'm just like, God. What, you are incredible.
She's so good. And there's this moment at the label party where she comes down the stairs to a weird remix of their song, like a jazz remix of their song. And then she's like, okay, let's go be girls. And then she does this thing where she frames her face with the backs of her hands and crosses her arms. And people do that now. Like, I've seen people do that.
Yeah.
It's so a joke, obviously. But she
crosses over, she makes an X with her arms and then puts her head in between her hands.
Let's go be girls. Yeah.
But then when she comes down the stairs, she's like, I'm Fiona, welcome to your party.
so funny.
And then the three girls, because they're like, well, Josie really is like the straight man in that, and she's just like, but then,
hey,
yeah,
Josie, how much do you weigh?
Yeah, well, and I found that I was like, oh, this is very 2001, but not
the,
in a good
the amount
way
they weighed. Yeah, because it's funny, because, like, it was a joke. It's obviously like this joke about, like, the obsession with weight and the blah blah blah.
Yeah,
but they do say their weights, and I'm not going to say it again because I don't want to ruin Ellen's day, but it's like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Like, it's a bit like when the Bridget Jones moments where she's 9'2" and she's freaking out or whatever.
Yeah. That sort of took me, I think that's maybe the only moment that dates it. I guess as well, a speech impediment being used as, like, the butt of a joke.
Yeah. And, like,
dates the film.
Albinoism as well. It's like, it's definitely a joke, but
because I read Wyatt as gay, or actually just sort of like asexual, just like in love with the record industry.
Yes,
I don't think
it's very much a Niles and Daphne sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah,
like, he's obviously a gay man who just adores this monster of a woman who's just the pinnacle of glamour to him.
Yeah, you know? But to me, I guess I didn't know whether he wanted her or wanted to be her.
Wow. And we spend our whole lives figuring those things out.
That's very true. But yeah, no, she's incredible. Who else is in the film? Because, like, it feels like,
Eugene Levy.
Hi, I'm Eugene Levy and I'm an actor. Stunning. Amazing. Stunning. And as well, satirizing the kind of the teen movie impulse of just getting random people in.
Yes.
And Eugene Levy had, like, obviously been in American Pie.
So it's so that.
Previously,
it's so clever of being,
it's just like, oh, we'll just roll someone. We'll roll a famous face past. Who will we get in? Eugene Levy's kind of hot right now. And
what's so fucking funny about that is that, like, the sort of the cynical take of like, okay, get someone from American Pie.
Yes.
Who's Tara Reid.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But the idea they would be like, oh yeah, who else is big in American Pie? Yeah. The dad.
Poor Jason Biggs.
You know, poor Jason Biggs.
Just uninvited to this party.
I know. Oh my God.
Yeah.
There's so many funny things. Mm-hmm. We've talked about Missy Pyle. You slept with him.
You slept with him. She's stunning. She's really, really hilarious. And she's like very physically funny in the film. She's always like just, she's like sitting weird. Whenever she's like even in the background, she's always like staring at someone with like dagger eyes. It's not even her scene, but she's giving it her all.
The tiny character, the guy from the CIA or whatever, from the feds comes in and she gives this big speech about like, whatever you guys, I'm perfect. And he comes in and just points to her. What the fuck is going on with her head?
There's a skunk on your head or something.
Oh, that's your hair. I'm sorry, but that's messed up.
Yeah, the government guy, when Josie is like, the government come in, she's like, oh, thank God you're here. They're like controlling everybody with our music. And the government guy's like, oh my God.
But she's like, that's crazy, real, right? Yeah. Isn't it like...
Oh, that was a real thing.
A real thing.
Yeah, I think in like the 60s, I think they touched on it in like the Queen's Gambit a bit, actually, funnily enough. Yeah, in the 60s, it was like cigarette adverts and beer. And then obviously like in the film, there was the join the Navy join the Army moment, which I mean, and this film was, you know, everything in the world is pre and post 9/11, but this came out in April. 9/11 happened in September.
I love that. So everything in the world is pre and post 9/11. It is. Which like, is true.
Like,
yeah.
Whenever you talk about anything, it's like, well, it was pre 9/11. Like,
it was 1941. Yeah. It was pre 9/11.
You could bring any liquids on a plane. Like, that's how different the world was. But yeah, like there's the join the army moment and the very overt wink to the camera of, no, we're not going to do it in music anymore. We're going to control teenagers via films now.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, there's so many different layers to that, because this film is then, you know, as you said earlier, like going on to sell teenage girls stuff
for
Universal Pictures. So it's like, I don't know, how far down does this satire go before it stops being satire, I guess?
And it's like, the thing of it still being relevant as well, even like, 2 years ago, there was this whole story about how the Conservative Party was banning anti-consumerist literature from schools or anything that criticized capitalism kind of thing.
Dear.
Like, this goes, this thing of like, yeah, and well, anything is, you know, it's their informational video is very like, what's good for the economy is good for America.
Good for America. And America's the most ass-kickingest country in the world.
Yeah.
And yeah, and I mean, it also kind of... It was a precursor to the whole Michael Bay shilling that all of his films do. Like, if you watch a Transformers film, every 2 seconds you'll see...
You watch a Transformers film?
Yeah, I've watched them. Not all of them, but like, if you watch like the first Transformers film, it's like watching Josie and the Pussycats when it comes to product placement. Mm. It is like disgusting.
Wow.
It's really, really bad. And like quite overt as well. Like, somebody might like pick up something and be like... Or like they're using a piece of tech to track down a robot. It's been a while. And it's like, oh no, use
track
this.
Track down a robot.
Yeah, use this. It's got like longer range, blah, blah, blah. And,
oh my
and they're
God,
like
really?
Listening.
To,
yeah, it's really bad. It's really, really bad. And a lot of those kind of action movies have all that shit in it. But it's fine.
It's fine.
It's fine because it's just a bit of fun. It's supposed to be mindless, blah, blah, blah. And then when Josie and the Pussycats, an actual intelligent film, satirizes it beforehand, people will be like, no, it's not clever because it's girls.
It's girls.
Girl stuff.
Girl time. And it's weird. The thing about Parker Posey in this as well is that she had already proved that you could do satire where you care about people, because that's what those Christopher Guest movies are. Like Best in Show and A Mighty Wind in particular. Like,
I love Best in Show.
I love it so much. But like, also, it's the silliest fucking movie ever.
Yeah.
But I still cry at the end.
Yeah.
Because Eugene Levy has it's like a movie about a woman who's like a man who's overshadowed by his wife, and he's a little guy and he gets to have his moment.
And he's the sweetest man in the entire world.
Yeah.
I would really like to meet Eugene Levy. But I mean, yeah, but that's the thing about satire. Like, you can't, if you have just pure satire, you have Idiocracy, which is an interesting film,
but it's
like
not
an
a
interesting
good
text.
Film.
It's not a good film because like, you don't care about anybody because there's one straight man in the center of a universe of bullshit and dumb people, mm-hmm. but the straight man isn't, we don't care about him, really.
We mean straight man in the sense of like,
yeah, he's like
straight.
Yeah, and also, reacting. And I think he's probably a straight man as well.
I mean, it's Luke Wilson.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, like, Luke Wilson did a good job with that film, and that film was, like, I think it is, it would be an interesting text to kind of, mm-hmm. you know, look at alongside Josie and the Pussycats. But what Josie has is, like, it's not even in character development. It's just... Mm. I don't know, it's quite overt in that it's telling you a story, it's not teaching you a lesson. Yeah. It's like, this is the story of a band who made it and gave, like, at the end, like, just stripped away all of their, you know, product placement and whatever it is.
And play a great fucking show.
And told you, like, you should decide for yourself. It's okay yeah. if you like it. It's okay if you don't. And that message is a really good message to give young teenage girls.
Yeah.
Like, that's a good, strong message after an hour and a half or an hour and 40 minutes of kind of getting the impression that teenage girls are stupid and being controlled easily.
It's so true because, like, to go back to that Roger Ebert review, that, like, the only bit of the movie he liked was that bit at the beginning when the teenage girls are freaking out, right? Mm. And, like, I keep bringing up Roger Ebert because he's one of those people who I actually do trust, or he was.
Yeah.
And he was a great writer and a sensitive critic, and he championed a lot of things that a lot of other people were poo-pooing just because it was fashionable. Mm. And so the fact that he didn't get this is very hurtful to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, he loves that sort of like, all the dialogue of the kids screaming and so on. I just want to touch them. I don't care where.
Yeah. I don't care which one.
And I don't care where.
Yeah. That's great. And then the guy there, he's like, yeah, I love them. Like brothers.
Yeah.
It's very, very funny.
It's so good. But like, then it's as the movie goes on, those like batches of screaming girls come and go or whatever throughout the film. But we come to understand that they are the victims of something. They're not just mindless teens who are mindless teens and let's laugh at the young people. Like they're victims of the whims of the controlling party, you know?
Of the adults, In the film. And it's...
Which is true.
It's 100% true. And yes, teenagers are like, they've got more malleable brains. Mm. And yes, you know, that moment when it's like, teenagers have disposable income because they're babysitting. And it's like, yeah, okay, they have a bit of disposable income. And yes, you can absolutely shape their future by what it is that you tell them is and isn't cool. And the fact that it doesn't lean in on teenage girls are stupid, but teenage girls are, like you said, like victims, I think is really important.
Yeah.
And it means that the end moment, which I guess some people might think is a bit cheesy for a satirical film, it feels earned when Josie says that, you know?
Because the fake lesson, the one that everyone rolls their eyes at, is there. So their manager guy, who I can't remember the character's name.
Yeah.
And to be honest, like, of all the zany characters, he's my least favourite.
I kind of don't care when he's there. I'm like, he's fine, but I could do without him.
If that character was gone and just Missy Pyle's character was the manager, that would have been great, I think.
Yeah.
But anyway, he sort of like does the whole like, I'm not what I wear. I'm not trends. I'm not what I wear. And he just like, keeps taking off his clothes and saying, I'm not what I wear. And it's such a, it's a satire of the kind of message you're expecting a film like this to give you.
Because that's not the message.
Because it's not the message. No. Yeah, because that's quite shallow and like, duh, also, you know.
Yeah.
But then having Josie on stage being saying, it's okay if you it's okay if you like it. And it's okay if you don't.
Yeah, because it's not.
That's a worthwhile message to give to girls.
Yeah, because if you in your film or your text or whatever it is that you're doing, tell teenage girls it doesn't matter what you wear, it doesn't matter what they tell you is cool. Teenage girls are going to be like, okay, try being a fucking teenage girl.
Yeah.
It does matter what you wear. It does matter what you like. Being cool is important.
I cried for 2 days when I was about 12 because my mom wouldn't buy me Skechers, red Skechers.
Right, like it's my mom bought me like knockoff Adidas that had like the 4 stripes on them instead of 3, and I was like, no,
you've ruined my
can't
life. Yeah.
I can't go to school with these. Like, this stuff is important. Like,
yeah, and I remember the 4 stripes. I remember that really clearly. I remember kids getting fucking bullied for that.
Or like Tippexing out one of the stripes, or getting ones with 2 and drawing on an extra one. Like, we would love if this stuff doesn't matter, but it does. It does matter. So I guess the message being like, you're within this system and you are getting marketed to from left, right and center, and people are making millions if not billions of dollars over teaching you what it is that you like. the message being ignore it all is so stupid, like, because that's it's completely impossible to ignore it all. And it's also taking a bit of fun and joy out of your teenage years and saying like, oh, don't follow trends. Following trends is great. Like,
when you dig a trend, ain't no finer feeling.
Yeah, like I was an emo for a bit when I was a teenager. Yeah. I was like, I followed like loads of different trends that were definitely marketed towards me. I loved Avril Lavigne.
Found yourself within it.
And you find people within it. So it's not a good message to kind of say ignore it all, but it is a good message to say like, just take what you like out of this.
Yeah.
Like, there's all of it's bullshit and all of it's being shoved down your throat. So just find the bits of it that you like and enjoy that.
Yeah.
Because you're going to be a grown up soon and you're not going to like anything.
So true. I hadn't even really thought of that, but it is really great. And like, even now where I feel like, you know, we're obviously in such a hot take era or whatever, and it's like, there's a kind of a scene or a fad or a thing that's happening, whether it's like wellness or TikTok. I'm rapidly running out of fucking steam. But there's always a thing that, because like, here's the reason why this thing you like is actually harmful and bad and dangerous. And then the sort of the people who are just so trying desperately to be ethical and, you know, do right by the world are get freak out. And it's like, it's okay to just take a couple of things from something that you like.
Absolutely. Like the kind of impulse that we have to like negate what it is that young people like.
Yeah,
like Harry Styles, for example, is a really good example right now. There is a huge cultural conversation about whether or not he should be, quote unquote, co-opting queer culture while not coming out himself. And then on the other side of the argument, people are saying, well, do you really want to force somebody to come out if he is queer and so on? And it's just, it muddies all of the water, because it's just like even having that conversation is distracting you from just enjoying Harry Styles's face and dancing and music and just being a absolutely gorgeous creature that you can just look at and enjoy. Like,
and
there's
like,
too much going on. These kids, let them look at him.
Let them look at him.
Leave them alone.
Not for me personally, but like, the fact that every time you look at a Harry Styles tour poster, the person who's touring with him is like fucking Jenny Lewis or like someone, or like,
he's like really good friends with Stevie Nicks.
Yeah. Like it doesn't matter if I don't like the music, he knows what he's doing and he knows where he's coming from, and I think it's coming from
I like Harry Styles because I'm not the biggest fan of his music.
Yeah.
I just really like him, but he likes the same music I like.
That's it. That's exactly that's what I'm trying to say. Yeah, he likes what I like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it makes me think that we could be together forever.
Together forever. We should wind up, but like, what's your favorite song or bit of music on the album, on the soundtrack?
Their big breakthrough song is Just Be Nice. Is that what it's called?
Pretend to Be Nice.
Pretend to Be Nice. Mm-hmm. I think that song is a masterpiece.
Yeah.
Like, I really think that that is a perfect pop song from start to finish. Like, it's the doo-doo-doos in it, like the message of it. It's gorgeous. I really love that song. Yeah. I was listening to it on the way here and I was like,
and that sort of like whispered bridge is so good.
Yeah.
Please pretend to be nice.
Like, I would like all over it. Absolutely all over it. Like, but all of the songs on it are great, and I include Du Jour's songs.
Oh yeah. Backdoor Lover.
Backdoor Lover is stunning. It's absolutely stunning.
Dang.
Like, it's great. And then I think they have like a Du Jour Around the World or something.
Yes.
Is there other
Du Jour
song?
The World.
Du Jour the World. Oh, is it like Tour the World?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. See? All these years later, and I'm still getting the jokes. But yeah, Pretend to Be Nice is my favorite. What about you?
For me, it's got to be Three Small Words.
That's great.
Because I think when I got an electric guitar because of this film, like an encore electric guitar from Argos. No, it was black, but it had a purple flower on the strap.
Okay.
You know, I really did feel like I could be Josie McCoy.
Mm.
But I remember trying to play Three Small Words and then realizing the pun in the song.
The come inside thing?
It was not so much a pun, but the sort of device of the took 6 whole hours and 5 long days for all your lies to come undone.
Mm-hmm.
Those 3 small words were way too late for you to see that I'm the one.
And then you're like,
oh
my
she's
God,
counting this is backwards.
It's beautiful. It's stunning.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible.
And like every person who worked on the music in this film, like there was obviously the people we mentioned, also Babyface, a producer, also produced I think half of the soundtrack and Adam produced the other half. Mm-hmm. But like he had worked with NSYNC, he had worked with the Backstreet yeah. Boys, but he'd also worked to kind of get that late 90s, early 2000s, like R&B sound as well. Mm. So I think it was him. I was reading that when he was brought in, he was really excited to do it because he hadn't done like pop punk yet.
Yeah.
And it wasn't his sound, and it wasn't him like satirizing his own sound. He was just brought in. It's like, we need to make this sound like a hit. How do we make it sound yeah. like a hit? And they did. There's not a song on this that isn't believable as an actual Backdoor Lover, maybe, like is
yeah, that feels like something you see over in the line. Get Him to the Greek or something. Although yes. the songs in Get Him to the Greek are also fucking great.
Yes, yes.
Susie Q, or what's her name? Rose Byrne's character in Get Him to the Greek has those two great songs.
Yeah, yeah. Even
they're
in
also about anal sex.
Even in Forgetting Sarah Marshall, the Inside of You, like it's kind yes, of yes. That's kind of Backdoor Lover-ish mm-hmm. in that it's a comedy song, mm-hmm. but all of Josie's songs are
yeah. Even the ballad is really good.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is the song that turns her evil.
Yeah, in the bath. I fully thought like that the Walkman that she had, which was beautiful, it had about 75 buttons on it, like the Discman. I thought that was going to fall into the bath and that's how she would have found it out. But the bath was just so superfluous to the plot. I was just like, why was she in the bath?
Just put Rachel Cook in the bath. Please. Yeah. It was still that like, one for the dads.
Yeah, one for the dads.
I was looking at that Discman. I was like, why on earth would you need more than 3 buttons on a Discman?
You need play, pause.
Play, pause to the same button.
And
then skip.
Forward and back.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's it.
On and off, but you just hold down play. It's fine. Like, what are all these buttons? Like, yeah. I don't understand.
When she's evil Josie, I think it's like such a good performance.
She's brilliant. Because she's like, she's got two lanes in this movie, right?
Yeah,
she's kind
yeah.
of like wide-eyed and like, does anyone think it's strange that this all happened in a week? No! Oh, I saw somebody like counted how much of the film was like screaming, and it's close to 10% of the movie.
Really?
Is screaming. And it is a lot of screaming.
There
is
a lot of screaming. Yeah. Yeah. I could have done with less of screaming. Like when the girls show up at their hotel room and they're just screaming and screaming.
I could have done with like, like if that, I like that scene, but if it was like half as long.
Yeah,
fine. Oh, and the other thing I wanted to mention was the kind of the cool Janice Ian character who was like the nonconformist at the beginning.
Yes.
I really wanted more from her.
Oh, totally. I wanted her breaking out of her like lobotomized sort of like control group.
Yeah, because that was really sad and we don't actually see what happens.
No, we don't see what happens to her.
And you're like, okay.
And the code word for her is smells like teen spirit.
Yes. Yeah, which is great. I really liked her. Because I hadn't watched this film in years, I just had it in my head that she was going to be like a player or that she'd get in contact with Josie or something.
Yeah.
But no, not at all.
No. It felt like that whole scene in the record shop was like a sort of a play on Empire Records as well.
Yeah.
She was very a character from that world.
Yeah,
you know?
Definitely. Yeah, yeah. That whole scene is great. The we should buy red shoes or like now we should get orange shoes or like I want to buy a 6-pack. You don't drink. I want to start. Like so funny and so overt. I do not understand how professional film critics didn't realize that this was a joke. Like it's
from the moment he said put the Chevy to the levee, they should have known what was happening.
Yeah, that's also I think the best joke in the
it's my favorite
movie.
I think
it's my favorite, the Chevy to the levee.
Yeah, it's like great. There's like lots of like silly little moments that I love, like just Tara reading the coasters or whatever, but in terms of like a joke I'm like
that's you can't beat
yummy.
That
yummy. I saw when the three girls were doing three women were doing their victory tour.
So your face went so serious there.
Three like women. I was like, they're in their 50s or 40s or whatever. I also think that whenever I see those like, oh, so-and-so reacting to something they did 20 years ago, I feel like it's very cruel to make them watch behind-the-scenes content of them being like really young. I was like, I would hate that.
Yeah, no, I don't want to engage with myself 5 years ago.
Yeah,
like,
don't make her watch this. Yeah. But apparently a couple of years ago, Tara Reid tried to buy back the rights of Josie and the Pussycats because she thought that it was worth making another one with them.
Yes, please.
Yes, please.
Yes, please.
What do we think that could be? Same cast, but it's women in their 40s/50s.
Yeah. I mean, reunion tour. But also they have to like do TikTok.
They have to
stuff.
Do Spawn.
They have to do SpawnCon.
Yeah.
Tara Reid's character has and we have to go around and like get all, like convince all of them to
that
like
real
come
Muppets
out of their
movie
life.
Sort of like oh I love those
scenes. So Rosario is living in like West Africa, just has been volunteering for like past 20 years and she like runs a whole like humanitarian thing out there. Josie is married with babies and she doesn't want to come back.
Yes.
She's married to the guy.
Alan M.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
I feel like pivoted to a Laura Marling place for a while and then it kind of sputtered out and is not doing that anymore.
Yeah. And Melody, they really struggle to find her. She doesn't come into the movie until halfway through because they don't know where she is.
Lives on a horse sanctuary.
Yeah.
Really
far away.
The hills. Yeah.
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 And then, they come back to do a reunion tour because they're all broke.
Uh-huh.
And I feel and then we get great cameos.
One of their songs has become like a TikTok thing.
Yes, kids are doing dances.
Yeah.
To one of the songs, and they're like, "Oh well, my horse sanctuary like is really struggling right now, so I could do with this money, guys," and so on.
Yes.
Or like the orphanage could do with money, so like
we
need to fund the orphanage. Yeah, I'd watch.
And Josie just feels like I need one more shot to prove that I can be a rock star.
Maybe her guy. I just refuse to remember his name. Like
Alan M.
Maybe he makes it after Josie.
Oh.
And then she's like, well, I was the star first.
Yeah.
And then she's kind of always bitter about it.
Oh, that's good. Mm. But how do we keep it the original tone of the movie?
That's where the TikTok stuff comes in.
Okay, if the sort of like quote unquote problem they have is subliminal messaging in their music to drive a consumerist culture, what is the problem that musicians have now that they could be... working against?
The biggest problem right now for musicians is streaming.
Yeah.
So we'd have to get streaming into it somehow. Mm-hmm. Maybe they could use what they learned about subliminal messages and put their own subliminal messages into songs.
To get people to buy CDs
Buy CDs. And it's like, buy Josie and the Pussycat CDs or LPs.
That's
or whatever.
Good.
So they have to become the villain. Get in
Buy
touch,
Tara. Oh my God, that's good. We
get
did
in
it.
Touch with us.
Well, that's that.
Yeah,
I think great script.
Call us, Tara.
I mean, you don't have to make it, but you can at least pay us to write a script.
Yeah, yeah, we'll do it.
I'm free, but okay. Andrea Cleary, you are a music journalist and podcaster. Tell us what you do.
I have a podcast called My Favorite Album with Andrea Cleary. It is out now. Mm-hmm. Season one is out, and season two is currently happening
in session.
Caroline will be on it soon to talk about Fight Like Apes, which is a gorgeous episode. I love that. And you can find me Twitter, Instagram, Andrea Cleary _ I think. And that's where my other stuff will be, I guess. Yeah.
Thank you, Andrea. It's been great.
Thanks for having me. This is great. Thank you.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. The podcast was produced and edited by me, with mix and music by Harry Harris and artwork by Gavin Day. If you'd like to email me about the pod, you can do so on sentimentalpod@gmail.com or get in touch with me directly on Twitter or Instagram @Zaraline.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders that we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.